Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
So what ultimately was it about Wells that is so worth talking about that he keeps coming up here?
Wait a minute, something's happening. Humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, The gas tanks for the automobiles spreading everywhere, coming this way now.
I'll take it on faith that people know about the broadcast production of War of the Worlds that made Wells internationally famous, because many people thought that it was an invasion of actual aliens. The point of playing this clip is not to show that the War of the Worlds broadcast was so good. The point is that Orson Welles so innately understood the America of his time that he seemed to tap directly into a mainframe of exactly what the American mind would find most provocative. Whether it was a nationally toured Macbeth with an African-American cast, or a Julius Caesar seemingly set at something like the Nuremberg Rally, and all of this in his early 20s. What we must remember is that Orson Welles was already world famous when he made Citizen Kane, catapulted to fame as a 23-year-old wunderkind for whom all futures were possible. In the next series of podcasts, we're going to trace Welles to the point of his prime achievement so we can understand what arrived him at this point when he seemed like he would become the Michelangelo of the 20th century, and also trace the forces ensuring that would never happen. François Truffaut, himself one of the great film directors of all history, and even before he became a director, a young genius of a film critic, wrote what's surely one of the most insightful lines ever written about Welles' achievement. Citizen Kane is only the first film directed by a famous man. Welles was forced to make not a film which permitted him to get started in the industry, but the film, the one which sums up and prefigures all the others. And my God, this mad gamble was very nearly won. Anything less than the world's greatest film ever made would have been a disappointment relative to expectations, and in the opinion of so many, Welles fulfilled those expectations to the cross of every T. But the price was the whole of his life thereon.
I like to cast a party the way I cast a play, with very special people, and the champagne must be equally special. Paul Masson, a premium California champagne of impeccable taste. Paul Masson wines taste so good because they're made with such care. Old Paul Masson himself said it nearly a century ago, we will sell no wine before it's time.
The 20th century was both a wonderful and terrible time for the arts. There were a lot of great achievements in the arts, but very few figures who have the kind of consistent and always evolving greatness over the course of a lifetime one gets from Michelangelo, Beethoven, Goethe. Perhaps there are a few, the most obvious being Picasso, and perhaps also Stravinsky or Yeats or Joyce or Matisse or Neruda. And there are artists you can make arguments for, like Thomas Mann or Shostakovich or Henry James or W.H. Auden or Philip Roth, or perhaps untold numbers we're still sorting through from places in the world that don't get much publicity, or artists who simply went their lives long without becoming known for what they did. But there is one art form in the 20th century where you really get an astonishing proliferation of creators who do interesting and varied work over the course of an entire lifetime. Ingmar Bergman, Louis Buñuel, Kurosawa, Werner Herzog, Ozu, Bresson, Kubrick, De Sica, Fellini, Dreyer, Jean Renoir, Fritz Lang, Satyajit Ray, even Scorsese and Robert Altman. Some, like Truffaut or Kenji Mizoguchi or Andrei Tarkovsky or Max Ophuls, dropped off in their 50s. In the case of the latter three, just as they seem to many, as though they might have hit the very peak of their powers. If you consider art film, or cinema, a high art, which, believe it or not, some critics, usually of an older generation, still don't, then it's easily the best art the world produced in the 20th century. So perhaps these pronouncements are completely premature. But even if there's plenty of great paintings, great music, great books, great poems from the 20th century, there aren't too many cosmic creators from the quote-unquote old arts, creators who made revelatory things when they were young and completely different kinds of revelatory things when they were old, with a line of evolution all the way through that Rembrandt did, or Turner, or Bach, or Wagner, or Milton, or Monet, or Haydn, or Titian, or Verdi, or arguably Shakespeare and Tolstoy, if you make for some allowances, but completely different kinds of art all the way through. In that way, there are rather 1,000 or 2 extremely talented artists briefly inflamed by the muse of fire before it moved on to the next vessel. Maybe there were those kinds of geniuses in the popular world. Alfred Hitchcock is the first who comes to mind to me, but no matter what point in Hitch's career and how ingenious his productions became, he was pretty much stuck on humiliating women his entire career, though the variety of ways he found to do it was undeniably impressive in its way. John Ford never really got over his macho gunslingers, even if his position on them seemed to evolve somewhat over the period from Stagecoach to The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. It's even harder to see an evolutionary trajectory in Howard Hawks, who was like a chameleon who perfectly adapted himself to every major Hollywood genre. Buster Keaton's evolution was cut short by the introduction of sound into pictures. Chaplin made a few very successful ones in the new era, but couldn't sustain the achievement. Ernst Lubitsch evolved, but he died at 55, and one had the sense that he had a lot more left in his tank to say. Others, like Frank Capra and Billy Wilder, lived to the ripest old age, but were shut out of the new Hollywood and unable to show us any potential new insights. Maybe John Huston was, but to be perfectly honest, I don't think all that much of his movies to begin with. And, of course, then there's Woody Allen. Conveniently, he hasn't made an indisputably great movie in more than 20 years at this point, so it's clear that whether it's old age or the salaciousness of the headlines about him, something made him decline pretty badly in his dotage. On the other hand, Steven Spielberg has certainly evolved and matured over the course of his career, and even if the trademark tics of sentimentality never left him, you look at the movies from Schindler's List onward, and it's immediately perceivable, at least to me, that there is a maturity to his later work that was unreachable by the creator of Jaws, Close Encounters, Raiders, and E.T. There are days in my life when I look at certain movies of his and say to myself that the real depth in Spielberg is so overlooked that if he were mentioned as the cinematic Shakespeare in 2500, my reincarnated self wouldn't be surprised at all. And then I look at the same movies the next day, and I wonder how the hell I could be so stupid, or how Spielberg could. So many art film snobs of a certain age hate Spielberg like anything because they rightly saw the death of their lifestyle in his work, perhaps even the death of art in movies. Lots of relatively early critics saw the death of various kinds of literature in what they took to be the influence of Shakespeare's barbarism too. Certainly in the 17th and 18th centuries, from figures like Voltaire and Samuel Pepys and John Dryden and I think even Molière. In that sense, both Shakespeare and Spielberg are larger than art itself. I'm still inclined to think this doesn't make Spielberg anything like the cinematic Shakespeare. Even at his truly imposing best, there are still so many gears that show, so much that feels like superficial manipulation rather than real feeling, that I would imagine that he will be an unforgotten side note in the history of art, appreciated for all those qualities which will make him watchable, even if future viewers looking to him for real poetic truth will seldom find it. Readers who are gluttons for punishment still pick up Les Misérables or Notre Dame de Paris, but neither book can ever hope to have the colossal impact on them that Victor Hugo once had on his contemporary French readers. Even if Victor Hugo doesn't speak to later readers anymore in a way that changes the curvature of the earth the way that Tolstoy or Dostoevsky or Dickens or Balzac or Flaubert do, stretches of his writing can still be pretty great. There are a lot of once colossal artists like that. We all know that they're not nearly as colossal as we once thought they were, but so long as you make allowances, what they are is still pretty great. A lot of genre fiction may turn out like that because it's so specifically self-limiting, placing arbitrary limitations on itself in an era when our imaginations ostensibly have the freedom to do anything at all. I would make another list of this kind of work, but you'd be listening for 12 hours. Even so, the sheer inescapability of Spielberg in our time is in many ways an indicator that his impact on the life of the entire world from now until the end of humanity itself could be very, very lasting, and that art itself might be something completely different before him and after him. As hard as it is to believe, he may perhaps be closer to Shakespeare than we know. Duke Ellington might be the best musical candidate in the popular canon for that kind of cosmic creator. Certainly, he evolved enormously as his career went on from the three-minute sides that made his name. Many of his longer-form pieces could only have been written by a musical genius, like Creole Rhapsody, Reminiscing in Tempo, Harlem, Black, Brown, and Beige, Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue, The Perfume Suite, The Deep South Suite, and Tattooed Bride. Others, like A Drum as a Woman or certain parts of The Sacred Services, are kind of embarrassing because Ellington sometimes fancied himself a writer as well as a musician, and when his writing became part of the music, the results were often not nearly as good. Of course, Ellington wasn't as important to the life of 1960 or 70 as he was to 1940, but he hardly disappeared. He just had to keep playing old hits to make a living. But he was evolving the whole time, a completely different composer at 65 than he was at 45, who was completely different than he was at 25. Had he the freedom to compose more new pieces, who knows? Maybe he could have improved his writing, too. The Louis Armstrong of his 20s was perhaps the most influential musician America ever produced, perhaps as a composer and a performer, player and singer. But by after the wars, Armstrong had completely reinvented himself as a pure performer, by the force of his personality. It's difficult to know with Louis Armstrong's Hot 5 and Hot 7 which were his compositions and which were just unrecorded songs floating around New Orleans, basically an oral tradition. His latter-day evolution makes it seem as though he was always much more of a performer than a composer, one of the greatest performers the world has ever seen, but nevertheless much less a creative musician than Ellington. Beginning with Charlie Parker, later jazz is clearly not a populist entertainment, but a full highbrow art in its own right. But so many of the most creative jazz musicians never made it to a full lifespan, the lifestyle being both so difficult and so substance-ridden. Miles Davis at least made it to 65. He certainly never stopped changing, and perhaps he'll be re-evaluated and later generations will understand all those things about those bizarre and drug-addled albums of his last 25 years that baffle us. Charles Mingus, dead from ALS at 56, with all his horrible suffering, both psychological and physical, kept trying to push ever new boundaries in spite of many periods when he couldn't compose at all. Maybe our new consciousness of underregarded female contributions to the arts and every other walk of life will cause us to reevaluate Mary Lou Williams and rate her as one of the absolute giants of the field alongside Duke and Miles and Satchmo and Byrd. Some already think Nina Simone is, but such was her temperament that she will always be a controversial artist no matter how good and how hard it is for women to succeed, and her style was always rather conservative and slow to evolve. Thelonious Monk also made it to 65, but in truth he probably maintained the same radical style all through his career until the jazz world caught up with him. Keith Jarrett has kept evolving for many decades now, picking up influences everywhere and may yet be remembered as a great American composer, in spite of the fact that many of his compositions are simply recorded improvisations in real time. John Zorn is now 65, and his music is so bizarre that it's difficult to say he's a truly great artist. But it's impossible to say that he hasn't evolved enormously over the course of his career. Ornette Coleman made it to the ripe old age of 85, and no matter how bizarre his music, it seemed to be a different kind of bizarre every year. Perhaps the most bizarre of all was Cecil Taylor, who just passed at 89, and just when you thought he'd reached the outer limit, he found a new way to shock the audience with something still stranger. Poetry, chanting, primal screaming. Like so much that is avant-garde, perhaps this is music meant to be absorbed by a new generation who's had time to live with it, but I still doubt that generation is one I'm a part of. Music theater, to which jazz owes so much, hasn't done much to recommend it in the time between Stephen Sondheim and Lin-Manuel Miranda. I still have my doubts about Miranda's staying power. The expectations after Hamilton are just so high, too high to fulfill. And well made as Hamilton clearly is, we'll see what comes next. And many people think that it's a weak roof next to the hip-hop on which it's based. Now, the hip-hop on which it draws is still in its beginning generations, and no hip-hop artist has lived an entire lifetime yet where we get to appreciate the whole output for whatever it becomes. But we'll see where LMM and his many extremely white fans and the giants of hip-hop go next. In the early 90s, Stephen Sondheim might have seemed an easy candidate, but for a quarter century, he slowed his productivity to something near a crawl. Perhaps some older Broadway composers might qualify. Richard Rodgers, Jerome Kern, Irving Berlin, Cole Porter. Their star has certainly dimmed in recent generations to the point that you have to be an expert at all to evaluate lifetimes of work. But all it would take is one enterprising performer or director to bring them back. A lot of people suggest certain great singer-songwriters beginning and ending with Bob Dylan. But even if Dylan still writes some pretty damn good songs, I doubt anybody would say that the many good songs of his last 20 years are anything to match the earth-shaking output of his majority's first 20, and honestly, Bob Dylan is always Bob Dylan. Folkish, gnomic, unknowable, so metaphorical that you never really know if it's as deep as it seems, even if it sometimes seems revelatory. Perhaps Leonard Cohen is a better candidate. I'm sure many people would hear the criteria and immediately say David Bowie. And his personas certainly speak to a certain kind of quirky genius for performing in fashion. But I'd be hard put to say that Bowie's music had much genius in it. I love Randy Newman, even if I'm the only one. But it's hard to say that Newman has evolved at all. He's pretty much the same satirical nerd his entire career. Maybe if John Lennon had lived longer, but we can only, imagine. It's tough to say that aside from the sound of the voice, there's much difference between the irony of Tom Waits or the earnestness of Neil Young of 40 years ago and of today. And as far as Bruce Springsteen can go, it's certainly a kind of evolution to do the pared-down arrangements of Nebraska and then the electronics of Born in the USA. But has he truly evolved in the 3.5 decades since then? I suppose I could do the same kind of cabinet rummaging for various stand-up comics or comic book and graphic artists, but this podcast, as always, is already going to be much longer than I'd anticipated. Ultimately, it's much too early to make any kind of definitive pronouncements, even if I were 100 times the authority I am. But it's hard to escape the idea that if that kind of genius was there, we'd have known because he or she would have made their work impossible to miss. And by that metric, Spielberg outpaces any competitor since the Beatles by a factor of N. Genius, true genius, comes from a place so deep that nothing is any longer what it seems. We call many people geniuses who are quote-unquote merely brilliant. Brilliance suggests illumination. A brilliant person can suggest possibilities we've never thought of in our lives, open our minds and hearts and souls to possibilities undreamt. Such a gift should never be dismissed and always celebrated. But genius doesn't suggest possibilities. It brings those possibilities into reality, fully formed and totally plausible. A genius doesn't just open us up to places, but to entire worlds and universes. The root of the word genius antedates Latin and even Greek. It comes from the ancient Arabic concept of the al-jinn, familiar, of course, to anyone who's dabbled in the Arabian Nights, and distantly to anyone who's seen the Disney version, which is Aladdin. It has the same linguistic root as words like genie and genesis and gene. It suggests not just illumination, but the very fabric of creation itself. Given how hard it is to peek through, I'd imagine that there are maybe a dozen artistic creators of genius in every century who are not just brilliant, but create universes of meaning so entirely different from anything before them that the world is simply a different place after they arrive. And in the 20th century, when there were so many brilliant artists yet so few who could distinguish themselves over everybody else, how do we even know yet whom they were? Maybe there were only a half dozen, or maybe there were 5 dozen. But movies are clearly the dominant art form of the last century, and at the very nexus of the place where they were made, the director with the vision to make his oeuvre, the crowning achievement of art in our century was denied every opportunity to fill his potential. And Jesus, doesn't oeuvre just sound so incredibly un-Hollywood, un-American even? And among all those great filmmakers of genius, there was only a single one who had the ability to make movies that take in the entirety of the American experience in the most American art form at the zenith of American power and ingenuity, and he only got to do it once. Whether or not Wells ultimately saw his life as a tragedy, and there's no real way of knowing exactly how Wells saw himself because he went to such great lengths to conceal his real self behind any number of fabrications and myths, there is little getting around the fact that in proportion to the talent he demonstrated, his inability to make more movies is the single greatest tragedy of the arts in America. Such a great tragedy that perhaps it's an indication that movies, with all their commercial compromises, now more than ever, are not meant to be an art in the manner of older, more venerable arts. Or maybe that's just a patina of sophistication that seems to fall over art forms as they achieve more critical veneration and less hold on daily life. I recently began reading Henry James's Art of Fiction, and there was the same complaint about novels that all popular artists seem to have in our day. Nobody takes this art seriously enough, and that Dickens and Balzac are relegated to the status of popular entertainers. The Kendrick Lamars or Drakes of their day, while dead poets like Shakespeare and Milton and Keats were at the top of the pantheon, even though the first was thought in his own day by so many to be a popular entertainer. Furthermore, since with Henry James came the sense that the novel was a high art rather than a popular entertainment, with James also came the sense that the novel was not for everybody. Balzac, Stendhal, Flaubert, Hugo, Dumas, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Gogol, Turgenev, Austin, the Brontes, Dickens, Thackeray, George Eliot, Melville, Hawthorne, all come from that period before roughly the 1880s when the novel was both thought a popular entertainment as something much more ambitious than it often became later. At the time, it grappled very earnestly with problems of existence without thinking very much about the formal cohesion of the thing, though clearly there are exceptions to that rule, like Flaubert and Jane Austen, who clearly write something much smaller scaled and formally cohesive where everything is very neat and finicky sentence by sentence that anticipates where the novel will go next. God knows it's not that mega novelists like Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Hugo, Melville were trying to create entertainment, but they were trying to say something much more essential than what they took to be art. Whether it was political as Hugo was, or religious as Dostoevsky was, or historical as Tolstoy was, or whatever as Melville was, they regarded their fiction almost didactically, as an extension of the existential problems on which they tried to give light. From the very beginning, Henry James began his career of writing a kind of self-consciously exquisite microfiction, whose point is to savor and magnify the significance of every last detail. Starting around 1880, when Dostoevsky died and Tolstoy abandoned novels to write eccentric religious philosophy, the novel became both a higher pursuit than ever before and something much smaller in its ambition. Popular entertainment can sometimes be the place where the greatest art of all is created. The rules of commercial limitations are pretty ironclad, but the rules of why this is art are as yet unwritten. The burdensome heaviness of later works, which is self-consciously trying to be lofty, is not there. So what you get is the serious examinations of art, but couched in the lightness of entertainment. This is how we get the plays of Shakespeare, the operas of Mozart, the novels of Dickens. But even so, it's too facile to say that every popular artist might be a second Shakespeare, so how dare you say anything critical about my favorite band? There are so many thousands of artists over the centuries from every genre for whom somebody made that claim about, only to find that nobody except for people from demographics or geographical locations close to theirs shared their enthusiasm. This is the brutal process of the arts everywhere. When you are not just up against your imagination, but against the practical considerations of what your imagination is allowed to render in reality. But there's no guarantee that your unfettered imagination will create something good. Sometimes limitations are quite helpful. I recently read an interview with Harvey Pekar, the writer of the American Splendor comics and a jazz reviewer for 50 years, in which he bemoaned that America had no passion for the avant-garde, and said that he believed that some artistic thought leader had to guide America to be more passionate about the personal projects of artists when they go in strange directions. On the one hand, that's absolutely true, and we need educators to get Americans acquainted with all manner of things outside their seemingly impenetrable comfort zone. But past a certain extent, that strikes me as self-defeating. If it's taken up by a large public, it's no longer avant-garde. The avant-garde, by definition, is daring. It dares those things that less brave artists would never dare. But ultimately, it would only make a small bit of difference and won't create more than a minimally wider public for them. Risks are not risks if they don't risk failure. So while avant-garde artists deserve a greater public for their bravery, they will, by definition, never get all that much more appreciators than they already have. But a few avant-garde artists, perhaps just by accident or because they're really that brilliant, create things of world-expanding sublimity. So how much harder, then, is it to push into unknown boundaries in the world of filmmaking upon which so much of the world economy depends? How many great filmmaking talents have been so severely curtailed by the limitations imposed by producers because of the risks involved? Producers streamline the product, and while I'm sure their presence prevents a lot of disasters, it also prevents a lot of magnificence. When every release needs giant commercial success rather than a product for a smaller but more passionate, knowledgeable, and guaranteed audience, we have a major problem because there will always be artists trying to make art for a more passionate, knowledgeable, and guaranteed audience, but if they can't find distribution for what they make, they have much less idea of what works artistically and what doesn't. The critical opinions of this audience, not just Pauline Kael and Andrew Saris, but box office receipts from educated doctors and lawyers and teachers and businessmen, is how the great art film directors of the 50s and 60s and the great American auteurs of the 70s knew what worked in their films and what didn't. Without the help of that larger public, these cinematic artists might have languished in the video artist obscurity of an art gallery where few people watch it for more than a few minutes at a time, if that, or might have gone into completely different artistic fields where they had far less chance to make a world-shaking impact. Unfortunately, in the brutal world that is the arts, the most avant-garde artists are the singular artists who find it hardest to accrue rewards for their product, either in the quality of their work or in the appreciation of an audience or in artistic remuneration. Occasionally, avant-garde artists of a certain genre get a real public, but it only lasts for a couple of years before the audience tires of the demands placed on them, and the average audience member is not perceptive enough to appreciate it as more than a novelty, which is all that much of the avant-garde is, though certainly not all. Maybe, with the internet, it's more possible now for daring avant-garde artists to get a real public than ever before. But even if that's true, it's still hard as hell for such artists, and the more recognition they get, the more chance there is for the larger public to meet them with hostility and ridicule. Hostility to what you create cuts deeply, and anybody who says it doesn't is lying. A lot of artists counter the hostility and ridicule against them by claiming that they make art only to please themselves. When bad artists say that, they mean it. When good artists say that, they're full of shit. That's where disaster lies. At best, they risk making work that only pleases people from niches who are exactly like them. So rather than an audience of educated, critical individualists, each of whom brings their own, often wholly different perspective, you have tiny artistic scene after tiny scene of like-minded individuals whom an artist cannot try new things for because he or she has to cater and pander to the monolithic prejudices of a couple hundred people upon whom the future of their career depends. Every artist is trying to say something with the work they make. However elusive or complex their message, there is some essence they are trying to communicate. And that communication needs a vessel to whom we are conveying what we wish to say. Whether or not an artist is working to please him or herself, there has to be an ideal listener and watcher to whom we're trying to tell what's essential about our ideas. And the more appreciative audience members we have, not audience members who lap up whatever we give them, but who are able to form their own unique meanings and associations, either in the moment they see it or later when contemplating what they've seen, they communicate the meanings they derived from our work to us. The more our imaginations can be taken in new and exciting directions by hearing perspectives on it that we, as the creator, would never think of ourselves, which can then inform the next work. There was so much great art in the 20th century, and so few great artists because the public was so enormous. It was so brutal in how it made gifted artists heroes one minute and villains the next. The relationship of artist to audience is a marriage in which both spouses continually sued for divorce. Artists are not artists without a public. The public shapes the artist just as the artist shapes the public. No matter how large or small the public before the 20th century, there were always patrons and aristocrats to whom an artist had to particularly appeal in order to make a living. But art in a democracy has only a public in which every spectator is quantitatively and qualitatively equal, voting with their time and money. In the 20th century, the possibilities of what could be art were nearly infinite, and therefore there was also infinite room for failure. Art is one of the toughest things in the world to get right. It's not a livable career for anybody who's not utterly obsessed with it. When you're young, your parents and teachers can discourage you and tell you that it's a difficult life, but you have no idea how difficult this life is until you experience it for yourself. The process winnows out the non-obsessives, because anybody capable of living a different life than an artist will have jumped ship by middle age. Even the successful live a stressful existence in which fame and fortune are accompanied by constant scrutiny and the pressure to live up to your last success. And because their success is so rare, they earn the resentment of thousands of colleagues who think that given their opportunities, we could have done it better. The mental pressure it takes to create even adequate art in a constant stream does not usually come from people whose brains are well regulated. Wells himself hated this kind of psychologizing about what makes artists feel the need to make art, and I'm a little ambivalent about it too, but there are so many myths surrounding Wells that he's one of the few for whom a little bit of armchair psychoanalysis might shed light rather than obscure it with darkness. Artists don't need to be crazy or depressed to make art, but only an idiot wouldn't see at least a moderate correlation. I recently went to a conference of composers in Boston and went to a talk on depression in music. The clearly depressed composer giving the talk spent a significant portion of it railing against the stereotype of the crazy artist and how dangerous it is to place artists in such a destructive box. And such an angry mob did he inspire in the classroom about it that I came away under the conclusion that the lecture was the best evidence against its own thesis. I can't do better than this quote from the science fiction writer Yevgeny Zamyatin. Real literature can be created only by madmen, hermits, heretics, dreamers, rebels, and skeptics, not by diligent and trustworthy functionaries. Obviously, it's not as simple as that straw man, and taking Kafka and Chaucer into account, the second part of that statement is obviously disprovable. On the other hand, Kafka was also a madman, a hermit, a heretic, and everything else listed in that quote. The problem is not that artists suffering mental illness is a dangerous stereotype. The problem is that mental illness itself is a dangerous stereotype, a condition which the World Health Organization estimates that 1 in 4 people suffer from at some point in their lives is not an illness. It is a fact of life which all people in the world encounter, either from suffering it directly or watching loved ones. The presence of mental illness in one's life is nearly as inescapable as death, but death is very brief. Mental illness often lasts an entire lifetime. Mental illness, rather, is part of the life cycle of any community, and the strength of the community's moral fitness and emotional bonds is ultimately measured by how well they can integrate the differences of those who do not conform to their norms. Those which find room for people who are different, whether emotionally or in infinity of other manners, have an evolutionary advantage, and their ability to adapt to the next era is greater because of it. If such communities historically die, it is usually because those communities which cannot abide their difference kill them off, along with themselves. But inevitably, it is the vision of these tolerant, forward-thinking communities which carries over to the next era, while the worldview of the intolerant dies with them. So think of the world after 1945. What did fascists win? In every generation, reactionaries want to recapture a world that can never again be, and we should doubt it ever was. Hitler shot himself in a Berlin bunker. Mussolini hung upside down in Milan. But the communists they wanted to stop inherited half the globe. Jews thrived in America, and Israel became a highly prosperous nation of its own. Gay rights took another generation to begin, but while their rights may soon be sorely tested again, the march of their progress is undeniable. Nazi Germany gave special awards and recognition to German women who birthed large numbers of children. 14 years after their defeat, the birth control pill was invented. And for an enormous segment of the world population, sex is an almost completely separate activity from procreation. While the forces of right-wing reaction in Germany are more powerful than they've been in 70 years, their conservative chancellor, Angela Merkel, has fought them tooth and nail with every trick in the book she has. She may have had to change her immigration policy this week, but she put up a magnificent multi-year fight, and the fight is by no means over. One could, of course, make a similar list of how greatly the aims of communists were thwarted, but the point is that the world is both predictable and in constant flux. In every generation, there are ever new versions of reactionary hatred, and yes, many of them can be found on the left in addition to the right, and occasionally, when things get particularly dire, in the center too. I generally oppose views which I find excessively progressive rather than liberal because of the instability which they inevitably bring. But even I can't deny that eventually it is the world which progressives long to see which becomes a reality. The difference between them and me is that I would like if at all possible, to spare us the inevitable seeming price tag. The point of this ultra-long digression is to illustrate just how difficult it is to create art, let alone great art. Artists live in a world that roots for their failure. Many artists come directly from the conservative or reactionary sort of background that roots for their failure out loud, because for them to succeed would contradict everything which their communities believe is true about life. It is the divide itself which this background creates that necessitates working in the arts for so many people, between love and affection for these people who do truly love them back, and the knowledge that these people who raise them hate everything they represent. The irresponsibility of choosing such an insecure career, their hostility to predictable norms, the winds of change their ideas seem to promise is imminent. So when some artists work through the conflicts of their origin years through the arts, however abstractly, it causes further levels of guilt, which necessitates the creation of more art. While it's not the dominant element, there's no question that this stability is part of the Wells makeup. And you see it particularly in the magnificent Ambersons, in which George Amberson, and Wells's full name was George Orson Welles, was, like how Wells probably viewed himself, the spoiled brat son of an immensely prosperous Midwestern family of suburban industrialists for whom all change is viewed as a threat. Booth Tarkington, the writer of the novel on which the movie was based, was a family friend who had come to stay in the Wells family mansion. Wells claimed, though it's not proven, to be descended from Gideon Wells, famous abolitionist and Lincoln's Secretary of the Navy. The Wells Mansion was in Kenosha, Wisconsin, a very small city bordering Lake Michigan, situated right near the Illinois border, across which grew perhaps the boy starring in the antithetical American story of their generation to Wells, Ronald Reagan. Kenosha was a Midwestern town like any other Midwestern town, founded in the 1830s and seemingly grew into a city because a railroad needed to stop there. Simon Callow notes in his biography that, quote, "Every country has its joke towns, good for an easy laugh, and if Kenosha is not quite in the league of Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and Normal, Illinois, it is still sufficiently redolent of boondockery to seem to mock the very idea of aspiration in its sons and daughters." An article about Wells appeared in 1947, which remarked that Wells is annoyed at his parents to this day because he sprang yelling into the world in prosaic Kenosha, Wisconsin. Wells replied in the article, "I never blamed my folks for Kenosha. Kenosha has always blamed my folks for me." Wells himself was not from the kind of background which Kenosha, Wisconsin would seem to denote, but his parents decidedly were, and made sure to move out of Kenosha before he was four, and so were many relatives of Wells' father whom they left behind. And yet the stability of certain kinds of families is also its own kind of myth. It's not usually the people who find great happiness in the usual kinds of family and community stability who lash out at those who pursue a different path. If that kind of life gives them genuine fulfillment, it would give them fulfillment to make sure that those family members they love who suffer under domestic expectations have the wings to become the kind of person that would give those oddball family members fulfillment. Because for those family misfits to walk around unfulfilled would be a threat to their domestic bliss. It's those people who do not feel domestic bliss that don't understand why others who do not fit soundly in the rubric of normal USA or normal anywhere else need another kind of life than theirs, because they feel threatened by those who pursue a different kind of life. Precisely because if such people succeed, it might invalidate their own choices, or still worse, endanger the security of their position, which makes their unfulfilling life just slightly bearable. Stockholm Syndrome is real, and far wider spread than anybody imagines. After a certain age, the real threat to people's self-worth is not the people who place limitations on their options in life. After such limitations are internalized, the real threat to people's self-worth are those who succeed in creating a different kind of life for themselves after we ourselves failed, because they show that we didn't have to make the compromises we made, and we could have been happier had we held on just a little bit longer. And this is, in many different ways, the story of Orson Welles' paternal grandmother, Mary Head Wells Gottfredson, who probably would have been much happier and caused much less turmoil in others if people like her could have lived a life like Orson Welles's. She was the daughter of the similarly temperamental and apparently quite powerful Orson Head, described as one of Kenosha's pioneer attorneys, who accumulated great wealth and helped to establish Kenosha society. Don't let that term, Kenosha society, fool you. Once upon a time, there were high societies and sharply defined social castes in every small town in America. Mary Head seemingly traveled without chaperone to St. Joseph, Missouri, so she could compel a freight clerk named Richard Wells to marry her. Wells spelled without an E, W-E-L-L-S, and brought Richard back to her parents, who were horrified. Mary then defied her parents by marrying him. She was 14 at the time, so perhaps this is where Orson Welles inherited his precocity. After Mr. Head signaled his harsh disapproval, they returned to St. Joseph, where it wasn't a long time before they'd spent her entire dowry. They returned to Kenosha with their son Richard in tow, and after her notoriously temperamental father passed, she moved into his mansion along with the family members who were so hostile to her life choices. Less than 10 years later, Richard Wells was so tired of Mary and her family that he fled Kenosha for an existence somewhere between a cad and a hobo. He was declared dead in 1885 so Mary could collect the patrimony her father made generously conditional on her husband's demise, but was cited as late as 1901. In the meantime, Mary went about scandalizing her family a second time by marrying a Danish immigrant brewer whose last name was Gottfriedsen. She became a society hostess whose gatherings were actively meant to scandalize her family's elegant manners with such wonderful innovations as charging admissions to her parties. Richard Head Wells, Mary's son, by then known as Dick Wells, was so embarrassed by his mother that he added an extra E to his name, so it was less likely people would associate him with his mother. Some of the next events are better described by Wells in two autobiographical portraits he wrote for Paris Vogue. They are the closest he ever came to writing an autobiography. Like everything about Wells, we have no idea how much, if any of it, is true. But they do testify to the fact that his grandmother was both mentally unsound and a kind of tyrant who probably could have benefited from a different kind of life than the family life, which was ultimately her only option. Quote, "A strange marriage all the same. My paternal grandmother put a curse on it. The ballroom on the top floor of the old woman's house had, in some remote period, been mysteriously converted into an enormous indoor miniature golf course full of wooden hills and nasty little sand traps, still partly covered with rotting green paper. Crowning the highest of the hills, there had been erected, at a later date, what was unmistakably an altar. Representing some more recent epoch in grandmother's spiritual progress, it was no place for Christian sacraments. The feathers of many birds long dead lay all about the golf course, and the altar itself was deeply stained with blood. This dreadful woman, dwarfish, obese, and evil-smelling, was a practicing witch. On the occasion of her son's funeral, celebrated in that huge house of hers, this hellish creature managed to sandwich some obscure passages into the ordinary Protestant service, so that the wretched, weak-willed minister was confused enough to read out during the ceremony several of the more bizarre invocations employed by Madame Blavatsky and great reeking dollops of Alastair Crowley. I was in no condition to interfere, being convinced, as I am now, that I had killed my father." We'll come back to the startling claim we just heard, but let's just start with the first, ever so slightly less startling claim, that Wells's grandmother put a curse on her son's marriage. Even if she did, the kind of person who puts a curse on her son's marriage is liable to be the kind of person who will do everything in her power to break it up in more corporeal ways. No doubt Wells did his grandmother a bit dirty in his descriptions of her. They're just a little bit too vivid. But Mary Head Wells Gottfriedsen sounds like the kind of person who was not well equipped for the situation in which life stationed her, however secure her station. And if she was interested in witchcraft, which is, of course, just a few spells away from the magic which her grandson practiced his whole life, perhaps had she been a man, she'd have had the chance for the kind of peripatetic existence lived by her husband, her son, and her grandson. But as a woman in the 19th century, most certainly not allowed to her. When her son came home with his future wife, Beatrice Ives, a woman of immense education and passion, she probably thought her new potential daughter-in-law looked upon her as a hick, and perhaps she was correct. It's difficult to believe that Wells's mother, Beatrice Ives, would ever bend to the will of a woman who decorated her mansion's dance floor with a miniature golf course, and by the way, whose mansion's facade was also decorated with giant beer steins. Furthermore, in the difference of education level probably also came political differences. Beatrice Ives Wells was a progressive and a feminist, and few people are more anti-radical than someone who has the temperament for more radical beliefs but must repress them. Mary Hetwells Gottfredson ran away from home when she was 14. She scandalized her family twice in her marriages, only to become her family's dowager empress in old age. Many people are bonded to their families and communities precisely because of how the communities made them suffer, because to admit for other possibilities for their lives is to admit that the suffering they'd incurred might have not been worth its price. And such people often are not only conservatives, but reactionaries. They don't want to keep things as they are, but actively change things back to the way that they thought things were. A person whose notions of high societies include charging admission, miniature golf, and giant beer steins is not someone who thinks highly of elites, no matter how much money she has. And a rich 19th century dowager interested in pagan mysticism is not a proto-hippie, but usually enthralled to the kind of mysticism that in a generation would suffuse the ideology of any number of fascist political parties. So let's now read how Simon Callow's biography of Wells vividly describes the period around Richard Wells' funeral when Wells was 15. But what of Wells' self-accusation? What matters here is not proof one way or the other, quite obviously he did not physically kill his father, but the fact that he felt he was, at the deepest level, responsible for his father's death. He was already riven with guilt about him. He had favored his mother over his father, was her emissary in the world, living out her hopes and dreams. He had perhaps wished his father out of the way. Often, in the years to come, he would frighten himself with the destructive power of his will. Perhaps he had used it here, with apparently direct results. Above all, however, Orson had, at the behest of others, abandoned his father. 6 months is an awfully long time in the relationship of a 15-year-old boy to his father. He had never let more than a couple weeks go by before without seeing Dick, and now he could never see him again. The loss of his mother occurred when he was 9, a child, and besides, he had never really lost her. Now he was a man. The loss of his father was irredeemable, a shattering blow. Having never really had him, he searched for him all his days, sometimes trying to be him, sometimes trying to create an image of him that would absolve the disappointment of the past. He remained an absence, a void, a gap deep within Orson which nothing could fill. For the immediate future, there was more pain to endure. It was decreed inevitably that the funeral must take place in Kenosha. Arrangements were in the hands of Dick's quote-unquote unknown mother, Mary Hetwells Gottfredson. Orson's relationship with her had never been a success. Despising Richard Jr., who, for obvious reasons, was not at his father's funeral, just a side note meaning he was in a disciplinary boarding school, she was permanently incensed by Orson, whom she regarded as unmanly. Orson fiercely defended his right to aestheticism. Their occasional encounters after the family had left Kenosha were fraught, with Orson defiant, not something to which Mrs. Gottfredson was accustomed. Her other grandson, Edward, recalled that Orson tried to scare Grandma with a rubber dagger, and when Grandma refused to become frightened, he dramatically plunged the dagger into his own heart and died as horribly as his youthful histrionic powers would permit. He was always emoting all over the place, explained Mrs. Gottfredson Jr., and egotistical as hell, added her husband. When Orson arrived, explaining that his father must be buried at sea or cremated, he was brushed aside. He persisted, frantic and tearful, and was ignored. His brimming cup of guilt must have overflowed. The final betrayal, to break a solemn oath given to a dying man. In addition to familial stability, the desire to create art can also come from broken homes. That kind of artistic background is so commented upon that I don't feel the need to add to it. You can find explanations of that virtually everywhere. But by having such august grandparents and great-grandparents, Wells himself had both in his background. Perhaps you need both in order to feel the urgency of why a different kind of life than either might be necessary to both endow you with the desperation to fall back upon your own wits, and also the hope that a better kind of life is possible. Wells's mother, Beatrice Ives, was apparently, among other things, a suffragette, a champion rifle shot, the first woman in Kenosha to hold public office, later becoming chair of the Board of Education, a great beauty, and a lecturer for all manner of women's groups who enrapture her audiences about Eastern religions, impressionist music, modern poetry, current events. Like her family, she grew up in Springfield, Illinois. Abraham Lincoln was her grandparents' longtime neighbor and friend. But for illness, stomach cancer, she might yet have found room for a wider career as a concert pianist. Frederick Stock, longtime music director of the Chicago Symphony, called Beatrice Wells the greatest woman pianist he ever knew. At the time, it was considered de rigueur for society hostesses to feed famous touring musicians who came into town. So by the time Wells' mother died, he may have met, according to differing accounts in various biographies, Stravinsky, Ravel, Prokofiev, Arthur Schnabel, Pablo Casals, Misha Elman, Alfred Wallenstein, and Yasha Heifetz. Mrs. Ives Wells homeschooled her son and taught him to recite Shakespeare aloud along with Swinburne, Rossetti, Keats, Tennyson, and Whitman. Why, she apparently said, should a person at his most impressionable age be shoveled into the sordid company of Auntie Nice's Kit Kat or Little Sister's Silly Red Ball? I'm assuming that those are kids' books of the day. In the same Paris Vogue articles, Wells wrote that children could be treated as adults so long as they were amusing. The moment you became boring, it was off to the nursery. Wells's school was the artists and intellectuals he met, and Wells convinced himself from the earliest age that he was one of them, drinking wine at 5 as though it were the most natural thing in the world, declaiming speeches in King Lear by the time he was 8, the same age when he would start mixing drinks and wrote a paper entitled The Universal History of the Drama, producing a drawing room version of King Lear with himself in the title role by the time he was 9, and at 9 he started drawing lines on his face so that people would think he was older. This was also the age when he ran away with a girl named Marjorie Watson, telling her that they would support themselves as traveling actors. At the beginning of their journey, he flung his money into a river and told her they would live by their talent or die trying. They were found in a small town 4 days later. He apparently was smoking cigars at 10, at which age he wrote a critique of Nietzsche's Thus Spake Zarathustra. We'll talk in far more depth about this precocious childhood next week. When Dr. Maurice Bernstein first came on a house call, which, depending on the biographer, was either to examine Beatrice Ives' mother or to examine a head injury from a fall of Orson's older brother, he was told by a 1.5-year-old baby that the desire to take medicine is one of the greatest features which distinguishes men from the animals. Dr. Bernstein would recall 30 years later to an interviewer, "I was astounded by the extraordinary mental maturity of the boy. He was talking remarkably sound sense at the age of 2, and I felt sure from his appearance, demeanor, and receptivity to paintings and sculptures that he was destined to become some kind of artist." Dr. Bernstein was a far better father figure than Dick Wells, but he was no role model either. He was something of a drunk himself whom Wells would have to give money in adulthood so Bernstein could spend it in some bar. On the one hand, he was an amateur cellist and composer of some ability who also knew many of the great classical musicians personally, no relation, though, to Leonard Bernstein. Together, Dr. Bernstein and Beatrice Wells saw to it that Orson would become the boy extra of the Chicago Opera Company. Even as a child, Wells became so heavy that he could no longer be lifted, which was often part of the choreography, and his career ended when Giovanni Martinelli, one of the great tenors of the age, said that Wells was too heavy to pick up. On the other hand, the reason Dr. Bernstein was in Kenosha rather than Chicago was because of an incident in which he was charged with attacking, beating, and leaving for injured a clinic supervisor. Earlier in the same year, Dr. Bernstein met the Wellses. He'd been married to the sister of the famed violin virtuoso, Misha Elman, but the marriage broke up after 4 months amid accusations of infidelity and dishonesty. After the death of Beatrice Ives' mother, come up to Kenosha so Beatrice could look after her while she was dying in searing pain, the Wellses moved to Chicago. Dick and Beatrice, Dickie, Orson, and Dr. Bernstein, whom Orson had apparently started calling Dada. Right around the same time, Dick Wells relapsed into alcoholism.
Much of what happened, what is discovered now, will of course be secret. We will not be given the full answer.
This has been It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present. Hosted by Evan Tucker, this has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?
and there was that same complaint about novels that all popular artists, and particularly their acolytes, seem to have in our day, that nobody takes this art seriously enough, and that Dickens and Balzac are can't say the name without laughing. Don't leave that in. And Balzac are... I've read his f***ing books. Okay. All right. The more I laugh, just cut it from there. The more I say it, and the more I'm gonna f***ing laugh. Okay. Are relegated to the staff. Okay, I gotta stop.